The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Entangling Vines, case number 18, Shangu's Sweet Olive Blossoms. One day, the poet Shangu was visiting Weitong Zuxin. Weitong said, "You know the passage in which Confucius says, 'My friends, do you think I'm hiding things from you? In fact, I'm hiding nothing from you.' It's just the same with the great matter of Zen. Do you understand this?" "I don't understand," Shangu replied. Later, Weitong and Shangu were walking in the mountains, where the air was filled with the scent of the sweet olive blossoms. Weitong asked, "Do you smell the fragrance of the blossoms?" Shangu said, "I do." Weitong said, "You see, I'm hiding nothing from you." At that moment, Shangu was enlightened. 2 months later, he visited Sishin Wuxin. Sishin greeted him and said, "I'll die, and you'll die, and we'll end up burnt into two heaps of ashes. At that time, where will we meet?" Shangu tried to respond, but he couldn't come up with anything. Later, while on the road to Qian'an, he awoke from a nap and suddenly understood Sishin's intent. Thereafter, he attained the samadhi of perfect freedom. So as Michael told us yesterday, so much to like about this koan, so much to engage with, so much to be challenged by, so much to savor. And I'll try to add something of my own to what Michael said so well yesterday. And as I'll start where Michael started, emphasizing that in Shangu, we have the rare koan that's about one of our lay ancestors, someone who didn't get into the genealogical transmission charts. So Shangu was a poet. And when we think poet, we might think kind of an outsider. This is how we've been brought up to think about poets in 20th and 21st century America. But that's really a tradition, this notion of the poet as an avant-garde figure, ahead of his times or her times, and not really honored. That's a romantic tradition that only goes back a couple hundred years or so. And of course, in our Zen and Shan traditions, we have figures like that. Han Shan, the allegedly crazy Buddhist poet, Zen poet who lived in a cave and became the patron saint for the Dharma bums, Gary Snyder and Phil Whalen and their circle, according to Jack Kerouac in his novel, The Dharma Bums, or Ryokan in Japan, the transmitted teacher who chose to live in a little hut on the mountainside and was quite eccentric, spent his time drinking sake with farmers and playing ball with children. Back when he wasn't in his little hermitage reading Han Shan. But these are more the exceptions than the rule. And in ancient China, to be a poet could mean to be an establishment figure. And Shangu was one of these figures. He had gone through the education system of the time, which was a system of education in the Confucian classics and the commentaries on them. And so he was a important Confucian scholar. In fact, he was regarded as one of the four great scholars of the entire Chinese empire of his time, which was the 11th century. This koan takes place a little later than a lot of our koans. The classic age is sometimes considered to be the 9th century. So this is a couple centuries later. That early luster is starting to fade, and teachers like Weitong are keeping it alive. So Shangu, a well-paid official, if you were a very successful establishment poet. You got a big sinecure. You got to be a big time administrator, maybe in a no-show job, having underlings do the work for you. He was a expert on Confucius. And so this is where Wei Tong starts with him, where he already is, referring to a passage that Shanggu would have known backwards and forwards and probably had taught himself, taught to his students, his Confucian students. You know the passage. Not do you know the passage, but yeah, you know the passage in which Confucian says, "My friends, do you think I'm hiding things from you? In fact, I'm hiding nothing from you." Well, so meeting Shanggu where he already is, he then throws a curve at him. Well, it's just the same with the great matter of Zen. This probably puzzled Shanggu a bit, because I expect that Shanggu was used to thinking of what we now call Confucianism and what was then called Chan and what we now call Zen as two very different things. Confucianism is often associated with proper behavior, with etiquette, with decorum, with behaving properly in a filial manner, giving due reverence to the ancestors, fulfilling your station that in life, the station you're born into. It's very much about propriety. And 18th century Europeans who gave Kong Fu Tse that Latin name, Confucius, they loved Confucius. They thought he was like them. They thought of Confucius as a great rational moralist. And quite different, right, from our notion of what, again, Jack Kerouac calls the Zen lunatics, people like Han Shan, who live in caves and write their poems on cave walls and birch bark. Not the kind of poet Shanggu was. So Shanggu maybe is a little surprised to have Kong Fu Tzu, Confucius, and Zen conflated like this. It's just the same. It's just the same with the great matter of Zen. Do you understand this? Having thrown this curve, it's almost as though Wei Tong is teasing Shanggu a little bit. And Shanggu understandably says, no, I don't understand. And this is where I believe Wei Tong wants Shanggu to be. This is what Shanggu needs right now. He needs to not understand. This is the guy who's one of the four great scholars of China. This is the guy who's known for his penetrating understanding, for his nearly unparalleled knowledge of the Confucian classics, for his beautiful poetry written in the proper manner of his times. Unlike, again, Han Shan, Cold Mountain, who wrote in a very colloquial style, a rough, Gary Snyder calls it a rough colloquial, a model for Gary Snyder's own rough colloquial American style. Shanggu, totally different. So don't think romantic poet, think 18th century poet. Think of the most proper poet that you know. And this is Shanggu writing squarely in the mode of his times. And now Shanggu is brought up short. I don't understand. This is probably a guy that's not used to saying that, that's not used to being asked a question he can't answer right away. He's the one who knows. And now he gets to be the one who doesn't know. And this is what those of us who set ourselves up as Zen teachers hope for our students. We hope that you will be led to a place where you don't know, where you're not so certain anymore, where everything that you are used to taking for granted suddenly starts to seem a little bit off. This is what we have been taught to do ourselves and what we try to pass on. And this koan is very much about passing on first, passing on insight, realization. And the first step again is to lead Shanggu to this place of not knowing. And then later, now, if you know me at all, you know I love this part. As soon as I read Wei Tong and Shangu were walking in the mountains, I start to smile. Because, as you know, I love walking in the mountains myself. And walking in the mountains is a hugely important part of my own practice. And I know it's not for everyone, and you don't need to walk in the mountains. It could be later, Wei Tong and Shangu were walking through the city center, but that's not what happens. They're walking in the mountains. And again, I think this is where Shangu, who's used to court life, who's used to officialdom, needs to be. He needs to be in a place with very ancient rhythms, a place not of geometrically designed buildings and straight roads, but a place of entanglement, to go back to the title of this koan collection, a place of tangled vines, of leaf forms, of trees and branches growing every which way, a place of meandering streams and wind rustling through the leaves and making the water lap. And this is where they are, walking in the mountains, and then something presents itself to them, where the air was filled with the scent of the sweet olive blossoms. Apparently their walk has taken them through a sweet olive grove, maybe one that was never planted but just grew up on its own, maybe one that was planted and then went wild, we're not sure. But there it is in the mountains, and it's filling the air with its scent. And that's this state of not knowing. I expect it's a while later. Shangu has been existing in this unfamiliar, uncomfortable state of knowing, something he's not used to, something he didn't expect, for some time. And this has left him wide open to what's about to happen. And at this point, it could be almost anything, but it's not. It could also be only this scent of sweet olive blossoms. And so Wei Tong asks him, "Do you smell the fragrance of the blossoms?" Seems like such a minor thing to ask. "Oh, you smell those olive blossoms?" Of course he does. But he's not asking because he wants to know. Wei Tong knows perfectly well that Shangu too is smelling this amazing fragrance. It must be quite amazing at this moment. We've all smelled something like that. Something that brings us home, but brings us to a home that we didn't know was our home. Not like Proust's Madeleine that brings us back to a memory, revives it to us, but that brings us to a place that we've always known, even though we were never quite there before. A place that's our true home. And so Shangu says, "I do." He really smells it, ripped open the way he's been, shaken from his certainties, pushed off his scholarly pedestal. He really smells it. It penetrates his whole being. And Wei Tong then releases the arrow, the second arrow that he's been keeping back all this time. "You see, I'm hiding nothing from you. There it is. It's right there." Wei Tong was in the line of Linji, who in Japanese is called Rinzai, and is credited as one of the important early figures, not exactly the founder, but considered the founder of Rinzai Zen, Linji Zen. And we read an excerpt from Linji a little while ago as part of the sutra service, where Linji says, "You know, there's nothing you have to do. You already have it. It's right there. You just have to take off that second head you've put on top of the head you already have. This, now, I speak now as someone who spent many years of his life as a scholar. This is kind of what scholars do. They put a second head on top of the head they already have. Scholars are constantly checking themselves, checking their references, checking their bibliographies, checking their quotations, checking their own thoughts, checking the claims they're making. This is what a scholar did in ancient China, and this is what a scholar does in 20th century America. Believe me, I know. And so here has been Shangu carrying this burden of the head on top of his head. It got him these accolades. It got him named, if he's already been named as such, as one of the four great scholars of China. Wouldn't that be fun to be one of the four great scholars of America? And yet, it's been keeping him from someplace important. It's been obscuring something from him, something that's as obvious as the scent of the sweet olive blossoms. It's right there. It can't be denied. And yet he hasn't been letting himself fully realize it until this moment. And when he hears this, when Wei Tong says again, "See, nothing's hidden." At that moment, Shangu was enlightened. Shangu has a moment of great realization. This phrase of nothing being hidden, this does go back to the classic, the golden age. What's called the golden age? Not everyone agrees. The golden age of Zen. It goes all the way back to the 8th century and to Wei Nong, the sixth ancestor, the last ancestor who is the ancestor of every living Zen teacher today, whether that teacher comes from the Rinzai line or the Soto line. We're all descendants of Wei Nong. The last time there was a single Zen ancestor. And in one of our core koans about Wei Nong, he's been pursued by the head monk of the monastery that he's been given basically the secret transmission at this monastery, and news has gotten out, and Wei Nong is a little bit of an unorthodox figure himself, supposedly illiterate. Maybe he was illiterate. Working in the rice polishing hut and not sitting in the zendo listening to Dharma talks. And yet he's the one who has the understanding and is given Bodhidharma's bowl and robe and then rowed across the river by his transmitting teacher, basically being told, get out of Dodge because things are going to be hot for you for a while. My monks aren't going to be happy with what I've just done. They're going to be after you. And the monk, the head monk who catches up with him, realizes that Wei Nong has something to teach. And the head monk, Ming, has a moment of great realization. And then he says to Wei Nong, in addition to this, what other secret teachings are there? What other secrets can you reveal to me? And Wei Nong says, nothing is hidden. Nothing was ever hidden. Just look at your original face and all will be clear. And so here is Wei Tong channeling this. Nothing is hidden. It's all right here. It's right here with the scent of the olive blossoms. It was right there in our earlier conversation, but you were being such a know-it-all that you weren't open to it. Now you're open to it. And at that moment, Shangu was enlightened. Now we would think, okay, end of story, happy ending. The Taisho is finished. Thanks, everybody. No, story's not over. Because whatever we think about the matter. And we may have started out our Zen careers, our Zen path, thinking that enlightenment was a single moment, a one and done thing, what one big flash. It's not. It's something that opens and then keeps opening. As Dogen says, not different from our practice. Practice and enlightenment are all the same. And so we don't practice till we're enlightened and then stop practicing. We don't practice so we can become enlightened and then practice is done. And we don't become enlightened and then just think, okay, well, good thing I did all that practice. Now I'm free and clear. No, none of that is true. And as I suggested at our last session, I like the term awakening because it suggests a continuing process. All of us are awakening. All of us here are awakening together. Let's not divide ourselves up into awakened and not awakened yet. All of us are awakening. And so Shangu has this moment of awakening, but it's ongoing. 2 months later, this time we know how long it's been. He's had 2 months to savor this, integrate it, let it sink in. He visited Cixin, Wuxin. Now, Cixin is the Dharma heir of Wei Tong, the first teacher. So he too is in the Rinzai line, the Linji line at that time. And so I love this. He's the chief disciple of the teacher that brought Shangu to the place he's at. And now Cixin is going to push him a little further along as a good student of his teacher, Wei Tong. Cixin, by the way, had what sounds like exactly the kind of enlightenment experience I'm telling you not to obsess over. He was walking and there was a storm. And those of us in New England, which is most of us, have been sitting together as storms pass through, worrying about our Wi-Fi. So he was walking and there was a storm and there was a big clap of thunder. And at that moment, he was enlightened. That was his experience. And as he's enlightened, he says, everyone in the world has attained Zen. They just haven't realized it. So a true teacher in Linji's line, everybody already has it. Everybody in the world has attained Zen. They just haven't realized it. Now, also echoing the Buddha, right? Under the Bodhi tree, when he says, I and all beings awaken together. Everyone together. This is not special to one person, to the person becoming awakened. This is a shared experience. They just haven't realized it yet. And Cixin is able to see that Shangu has more opening to do. He had this wonderful experience with Cixin's teacher Wei Tong, but still more to open up to, still more to realize, still more to integrate. And so he greets him with this really in-your-face kind of teaching. So I'll die and you'll die. What a nice way to greet somebody. Hi, I'll die and you'll die. I'll die and you'll die. And we'll end up burned into two heaps of ashes. Let's not airbrush it here. At that time, where will we meet? And so we get a little koan within the koan. Where will we meet when we're dead? So all of us, by the way, right? All of you have attained Zen. You just may or may not realize it. So all of us will meet after we're burnt up and our heaps of ashes, or however you've chosen to go, or your heirs choose for you to go, rotting in the ground, or burnt up, or maybe you can afford to get an expensive sky burial like they do in Nepal, and the birds will take little pieces of you away. That's how I'd like to go, but I'm afraid it was just too much vanity involved in that. But where will we meet? Where will we meet? So back to the great matter of Zen, right? Wei Tong said, it's just the same with the great matter of Zen. And great matter of Zen is the great matter of life and death, the great matter of birth and death. So right back to that. What about that? What about when we're dead? Where do we meet then? What's going to happen? Where are we then? What about the scent of sweet olive blossoms when we're dead? What about that thunderclap when we're in the ground? What happens? Who do we think we are? How bound up are we? How totally convinced are we that the self contained within our skin bags, within our skin membrane, is everything we are? How certain are we that what can be burnt up on a funeral pyre or in a furnace at a mortuary, how certain we are that what can be reduced to a pile of ashes is us? Do we, when we read your true self is the world, do we ever believe it? All of these Zen things that we hear about no self, about our not stopping with the self that we're aware of, about that self not being solid, not being impermeable, but being part and parcel of everything else. Do we ever actually believe that? As one of the koans says, are we willing to live and die like that? So much easier for me, and maybe for you, to think about what has been called inner being, but also dependent co-arising or mutual co-origination. The fact that everything is intertwined with everything else. Nothing stands by itself. Everything is part and parcel of everything else. So much easier for me to think of that as applying to everything but me. Somehow I stick out. Somehow it's a little harder for me to see myself as not a whole, as not self-sufficient, as not complete, as not bounded, as not an identifiable I or me. That's the hard one, to really let that go. Why is it that when I stand in a field and turn around 360 degrees, I seem to be right in the center of the universe? Isn't that true? Am I just a little part of it? That's not even a bounded part. Am I just drifting through it the way that the scent of the olive blossoms is drifting through the woods and the mountains? Am I just a temporary temporary condition brought about by shifting temperatures and energy fields like a clap of thunder? What is a clap of thunder? Is it a thing? What are you and me? Are we things? So this is where Cixin Wuxin, in his great compassion, inspired by the compassion of his own teacher, brings our hero, Shanggu, our poet, who I think is now ready to really be a poet. So let me read this to you once more. Shanggu's sweet olive blossoms. One day the poet Shanggu was visiting Wei Tong Zuxin. Wei Tong said, You know the passage in which Confucius says, "My friends, do you think I'm hiding things from you? In fact, I'm hiding nothing from you." It's just the same with the great matter of Zen. Do you understand this? "I don't understand," Shangu replied. Later, Wei Tong and Shangu were walking in the mountains, where the air was filled with the scent of the sweet olive blossoms. Wei Tong asked, "Do you smell the fragrance of the blossoms?" Shangu said, "I do." Wei Tong said, "You see, I'm hiding nothing from you." At that moment, Shangu was enlightened. 2 months later, he visited Cixin Wuxin. Cixin greeted him and said, "I'll die, and you'll die, and we'll end up burnt into two heaps of ashes. At that time, where will we meet?" Shangu tried to respond, but couldn't come up with anything. Later, while on the road to Qian'an, he awoke from a nap and suddenly understood Cixin's intent. Thereafter, he attained the samadhi of perfect freedom. Thank you. So please sit comfortably, and we will move into Dharma dialogue. And when you're ready to ask a question or make a point, it could have something to do with my talk, with the koan or not, anything that's alive for you. And I'll ask Michael to help me respond to your questions and statements. And so we start with Betty.
Hi, thank you for your talk, Alan. I came to this Cixin with a lot of trepidation. I've been feeling pretty disconnected with my practice for whatever reason. I mean, I kind of know all the reasons why I've been feeling disconnected. They could go on forever, so I won't tell you those. But just to say that, in a nutshell, I retired a couple of years ago, and I was a nurse for 40 years, an inpatient psychiatric nurse for the most part. And when I knew I was going to do another career when I left. I mean, I wanted to have it all set up when I left, but I didn't do that. And so I finally decided I was going to train to be a life coach. And I did this training. And since then, you know, I have a website and everything, but it's been really hard to grow the business. And part of it is that it's hard to grow a business. When I worked, I went to the hospital, the patients were all there. I didn't have to go find them. I didn't have to ask them for money. The hospital paid me. So it was a very different thing. But it isn't, I mean, there's more to it than that. And part of it has been this fear of going forward, fear of, you know, I'm not quite like this high poet. You know, I don't feel as confident about my past as he probably was feeling. So I've been either avoiding things or numbing myself to it. And it's been really hard. And I just realized that it's okay for me not to know how to do this. You know, that's the way it is. And somehow I'm just going to have to go forward with that. And I think I can do it. I think I will be able to do it. It's just not the way I thought it was. It's just not the way I thought it was going to be. So anyway, I feel a little bit more connected to how my practice can help me to move forward with it, you know, because it is this not knowing how to do things. And even being a coach, I mean, you know, that's what people need you to do with them. So anyway, that's what I've gotten from coming to this and listening to this. This particular koan was really helpful to me. The part about the piles of ash and everything, I haven't gotten there yet, but it is all about meeting, you know, meeting the client and meeting yourself.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say. And I appreciate the talk and I appreciate everything that has happened. Even the readings have been great.
Yeah, thanks, Betty. And it's like we're watching you take the head on top of your head off, put it aside, right? And say, it's okay just to blunder my way into this because in fact, that means I'm going to be open to what the clients I get will be bringing to me. And I'm not going to sit there being the one who knows, which is not how, you know, how you teach it really and not how you coach really.
Right.
A lot of teaching or coaching is about listening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's as though what you're saying is, I'm really ready to listen now. Yeah, how wonderful.
Possibly. I hope so.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Barry.
A pity. Here I am talking again.
You're the only one who thinks that, Barry. All the rest of us are. What will Barry say?
Oh, boy. That's a good teacher. Encouraging. First of all, I was impressed by Shandu, that I've known a lot of experts that forget opening their minds for new ideas when they get to a certain plateau. And somehow this fellow had a certain amount of openness, which impresses me. Heaps of ashes. Where will we meet? My answer is there's no we to meet. And one of the profound influences on my career is a suicidologist now dead named Edwin Schneidman. And he was a thanatologist, studied death, and he was a suicidologist. And someone asked him shortly before he died, what's next? He said, nothing, it's over. And his statement carried a lot of weight because of his credentials in his field, but it brings me back to the great river of being again. Yeah. That's it. But we continue in some way that has no we, is my opinion.
Yeah, thank you, Barry. And so you know, as you quoted that, nothing, it's over, and then you gave your spin on it, it's as though that also means everything, it's over.
Say again, please.
Everything, it's over. Nothing, it's over. Everything, it's over. What happens next? Everything, it's over.
Okay.
There's your great river of being.
Oh.
Is it nothing or is it everything? Michael?
You know, Barry, I really appreciate you coming forward and talking about this person that influenced you and influenced your idea and your view. And that, those are usually helpful and often helpful in our teachers and such. But I really appreciate how Alan talked about this, the scholarship that his career has turned. And to some respect, we're all scholars. We went to school at one point, but not to the level of having a career in it. I don't know everyone here, but that this putting another head on top of the one you already have, it's quite common. In fact, I think we all do it, and that we're checking ourselves. We're checking I'm experiencing something. I wonder what this is like. And then we look to someone else and we put their experience on ours. The rawness of just coming forward and saying, this is how I see it, is priceless. And I think this is one of the things we really cultivate here in this practice. A little bit further on in Linji's sutra that we read today, he says, it's only because you lack confidence. And this confidence, I think, is very elusive, because we have the voice that says, yeah, that's right, but, and then it kind of, and we checking ourselves. So checking ourselves against reality is one of the path that we take, but checking yourself against someone else's opinion or someone else's view is also can be a dead end. Thank you.
Just one comment about heads on top of heads. It's not always bad. The Northwest Coast Indians have totem poles, which are heads on top of heads. A beaver, an eagle, a bear, a salmon, and it actually has great complex meaning.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I completely agree. And we don't pop into reality with all the full wisdom and knowledge already buried in us. We collect it from everywhere. And it's our connection to humanity. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks, Barry. And I love that you brought that. You know, I'm from the Northwest, so I grew up seeing these totems. And I'm thinking it would have been really different if Linji had said, you're all putting a salmon and a bear and a beaver on top of the head you've already got. That would be quite a different statement. So thank you for giving us that image. Madhu.
Yeah, so I also came to Zen thinking that I'm going to get it at some point. Like, honestly, like this was a moment of, you know, reality testing for me. And I try all the time, like, you know, maybe this is where I need to go. And sometimes I look at Michael and Alan on the screen and this is probably where they are at. And I'm going to try to go where they are at. So I do try, but after all these years, I'm slowly sinking in that probably, you know, whatever I think the reality or the truth, you know, it probably doesn't have any real face that, you know, even if I get there, the face is probably going to change and it does change. So, I mean, you know, and so we just hang out in this place where things are constantly changing and there is no ground. And then just like, you know, you're just there and this is where we are at moment to moment. It's a very difficult place to be for me. Like, it's really hard. And the breath and everything, yeah, it's grounding and breath is beautiful, but, you know, breath is also very difficult and the body is, you know, sensations are not always pleasant. And this is where we all are hanging out all the time, it seems like, when you're doing Zazen, like, you know, it's, yeah. So that's what came up for me.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, hanging out at the edge, that's where you want to be, at that edge. So great that it's not too comfortable for you. Yeah, Shunyu Suzuki said this thing that sounds kind of odd, which was, he said once that those of his students who felt no pain in their legs had a much harder time understanding Zen than the ones who had pain. And I think it's, you know, maybe they were a little too comfortable and they were enjoying the in-breath and out-breath just a little. You should enjoy them, but you should have that edge too that you're talking about. And, you know, yeah, Michael Allen, you know, as well, you're going to be Madhu, you know, that's going to be your awakening. And you know, it's like, you know, is it the clap of thunder? Is it the sweet blossoms? It's whatever it's going to be next. Nobody can predict it. I used to drive myself crazy when we do Rohatsu Sesshin and the teachers would talk about the Buddha, or not Rohatsu, but Spring Sesshin, and the teachers would talk about the Buddha seeing the morning star. And then, you know, I'd go out to my tent and the stars would be out and I just, come on. Will it happen? And no, it wasn't the stars. That was somebody else. So just keep practicing and let yourself be surprised like our friend Shangu was.
Yeah. You know, I want to say, thank goodness Madhu doesn't get it. You know, that's the place to hang out. That's the gold, is right there. If you got it, then you'd be lost. That's the place.
Thank you.
Yeah, Kevin. You need to unmute, Kevin.
This is the second day we heard the story. And today was the first time I heard that Shangu. The poet, that the second person that he visited with was the student of the first. And the second person greets him and says, hey, you and I are going to die. How about that? And then my thought is, oh, the teacher has died in between. The first teacher has died. And that's why he's going to see the student. And then my second thought is, it doesn't matter at all if the teacher has died. That's why it's not in the story. It's completely irrelevant to the story whether the teacher is alive or dead.
Yeah, absolutely. What wonderful point. And there are koans, you know, where somebody gets to a certain point with a certain teacher and then that teacher dies. And so they go and they hunt down the disciple of that teacher. in fact, sometimes the teacher has left a message for them to do that. And this isn't one of those koans, as you say. In this case, it doesn't really matter. The first teacher may or may not have died during those 2 months. It's irrelevant. But I agree that I had that moment too, where I was tempted to wonder about that. But it may just be that the teacher said to Shangu, "Hey, I've got this former student who's a teacher. Go talk to Cixin. You know, see what he has to say." So that's also possible. It was just casual, and mm-hmm. Kind of a tribute, you know, to this teacher's lineage. So mm-hmm. so yeah, it doesn't matter. Thank you, Kevin. Brad.
I'd like to talk about sudden and gradual enlightenment. It seems I used to muse in my first couple Zen years of setting up a little amusement park that had sudden things happen, apples dropping out of trees or stones striking bamboo. Can I organize my life to be shocked into enlightenment, I guess? And it does seem like Kensho, as it was talked about in my early days. One friend of mine who stopped doing Zen said that Kensho was a really harmful concept for her. She did many 7-day sesshins and strove for a long time, and I don't know why it was harmful, but it seems to me the same tension is happening in me as well. And I remember Melissa Roshi saying at one point, yeah, there's sudden enlightenment, but there's also gradual enlightenment. And that kind of comforted me, like, okay, I can keep plodding along without this thunderclap where it all comes together. So, and it does seem the gateway would be in the moment, and that the answer to every question in Dokusan is something I'm experiencing right now. I don't know. I hope that reveals my consternation and my plight and my commitment to keep plotting. So,
yeah.
If you have any comment on that.
And maybe it will be sudden. You know, you don't know how it will happen. Nobody does. Dogen says it's not going to be what you thought it was going to be. That's one of the things Dogen's very clear about. Nobody says, "Oh, this is enlightenment, just like I thought it would be." Dogen just comes out and tells us that. So yeah. And I love your idea of a little theme park with thundercloud over here and stone hitting bamboo over there, and you know, the olive blossom scents being piped in over there. And in fact, some teachers have, you know, done things kind of like that with the shouts and blows, which we don't do anymore, right? Those are ways of trying to make that little theme park in the Zen Dojo. Peter Matheson tells a story about his teacher, Eido Roshi. Peter Matheson is at this sesshin, and he's kind of feels himself trembling at the verge of some kind of opening. And Eido Roshi comes over and just screams in his ear. And that pushes Peter over the edge. And then in Dokusan, he says, "Oh yeah, you screamed at me." And Eido goes, "Yeah, well, you needed to hear that scream." I don't know. That to me sounds sort of hokey, and I'm glad that we don't do that. But to me, it sounds a little bit like your amusement park. But teachers have resorted to this. So yeah, the important thing is not to worry about sudden or gradual, and just the thing is not the talk on the bamboo or the scream in the ear or the flash of lightning or the peal of thunder. The thing is the openness, the not knowing, the radical openness that we saw in Shangu and that he brought to what happened later. That's the important part. what happens and how it happens isn't important.
You know, Dogen also said, realization is reality right now. You will never awaken up in the future. You will never have Kensho in the future. It will only be right now, gradual or sudden. It's a matter of degree and who knows to what degree. So if you're placing some idea out into the future, you'll never get there. So thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Brad. Jenny.
Yeah, picking up on that thread, I keep thinking about, I've heard at Sashin before, today's enlightenment is tomorrow's delusion. And that saying, oh, it happened this way, and then say, freeze that and move it over here. Okay, can I make it happen? And I want to even do that with my own life. Like, it happened in the mountains. I have to go back to the mountains, you know, but yeah, it's a dead thing already when I'm trying to recreate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Jenny. And also, today's delusion is tomorrow's enlightenment. I think what you said is reversible.
And just add that this is the reason why we have teachers. You cannot judge your own practice. You cannot judge any of this. Teachers are so important in this on this path.
Grateful for teachers.
Pierce, you can have the last word of Zen this morning.
Thanks, Alan, for the talk and for leading us through the koan, which really enabled me to imagine what the poet's experience is like. And this particularly eloquent riff that you went on, where you are enjoining us to look at self and world. You know, that reading that you referred to by Uchiyama, your true self is the entire world. That's a favorite reading of mine. And there's even a little line in there that always gives me a charge, where he says, there's no possibility of exchange. Mm. Because if there's no separation, how can there be exchange? But at the same time, while you were doing this, I noticed my resistance to it, my reluctance to believe it or derive comfort from it, which is what I experienced yesterday. But this morning during the sutra service, I had this thought, which also came up today. It's not like you think it is. It has nothing to do with what you think about it. And just this idea of everything, that word came up, and it was somehow tremendously comforting. Everything doesn't just include me. It's, I am everything. That's what Uchiyama is saying. And so I think it's also significant that it occurred in the context of this formal practice, because the sutra service for me is also zazen. Mm. I mean, you know, so is Samu, et cetera, et cetera. But just the fact that here I am on Sesshin doing this, and I create a possibility of having this kind of, it's not really understanding, it's just a moment. Mm. Yeah, so thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Pierce. And once more, right, one more illustration of the head coming off of the head. And yeah, and then this possibility of understanding in a very different way. Thank you, everyone.